It is Friday, September 28th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, a Senate committee votes Friday on Brett Kavanaugh's nomination to the Supreme Court.
This is a political question at this point, and I think that those members of the Senate on the Republican side realize that this issue is about the midterms and about the general elections that will be coming up 2 years after that.
The head of the World Health Organization urges policies to save lives, and a blind Kurdish musician experiences life in the United States through music. It's all ahead. The Senate Judiciary Committee votes Friday afternoon on whether to recommend Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh to the full Senate, following a day of dramatic testimony by the appellate judge and Christine Blasey Ford, the woman who has accused him of sexual assault. It's not clear if the Republicans will have enough votes for their nominee after the impassioned testimony Thursday when Kavanaugh angrily denied a charge of sexually assaulting Ford at a party in 1982 when they were teenagers. Both told their stories to the Senate Judiciary Committee during a nearly nine-hour-long hearing. The American Bar Association late Thursday urged the Judiciary Committee and the full Senate to delay the vote until the FBI has time to do a full background check on the claims made by Ford and other women. Committee Chairman Charles Grassley on Friday said he would support Kavanaugh's nomination.
I found Dr. Ford's testimony credible and believe she's sincere in her version of the facts. But I also found Judge Kavanaugh's testimony credible and sincere. Ultimately, the existing evidence, including the statement of three alleged eyewitnesses named by Dr. Ford, refutes Dr. Ford's version of the facts. There is simply no reason to deny Judge Kavanaugh a seat on the Supreme Court on the basis of evidence presented to us.
Senator Dianne Feinstein, the committee's ranking Democratic member, questioned moving ahead with a vote on Kavanaugh following Ford's testimony about her alleged sexual assault.
My colleagues are right that we should not rush to judgment, and it's not fair to assume Judge Kavanaugh is guilty without gathering the information. But it's equally unfair to have heard from a credible, poised, and brave witness and simply ignore what we heard and move forward immediately.
Republican Senator Orrin Hatch called for a vote in favor of Kavanaugh.
I just have to say, let's be fair about this. Let's vote whichever way we want to, and let's move on this. There, I personally am tired of all the games and all the gamesmanship that's been going on around not just this nominee, but others as well.
Democratic Senator Patrick Leahy called out the Trump administration.
This Judiciary Committee is no longer an independent branch of government, and we're supposed to be, the Senate's supposed to be, an independent, equal branch of government. We're no longer that, but we are an arm and a very weak arm of the Trump White House. Every semblance of independence has just disappeared. It's gone. And I think that is something historians will look at, and they'll call it a turning point in the United States Senate.
But Republican Senator Lindsey Graham said Kavanaugh would ascend to the swing seat on the Supreme Court formerly occupied by Justice Anthony Kennedy.
But this is high-stakes stuff. Right? This is the seat where the guy in the middle is at risk. Kavanaugh clerked for Justice Kennedy. Would you have picked him? No. But you lost the election. And that does have consequences.
For some perspective on the Kavanaugh nomination, International Edition's Lori London spoke Thursday after the Kavanaugh hearing with criminal defense attorney and former CIA operative Jack Rice.
We've never seen anything like this in a very long time. But one thing that I look at now, and it's very clear, is that Dr. Ford, honestly, was credible. She was. And I think even the Republicans grudgingly said that. I think what we also found out was it doesn't particularly matter. It appears that they're going to be able to push this through and they're going to be able to vote. I guess there's one other issue, though, that is important. Not only were we talking about the potential nomination and confirmation of the next U.S. Supreme Court justice, but also about the midterm elections. Nobody said that, but that was also the underlying question that was going on today.
She, many people are saying, seemed very credible. What about Judge Kavanaugh? He seemed at times to get pretty aggressive, particularly towards some of the Democratic senators that were asking him questions.
What stuck out to me regarding Judge Kavanaugh's testimony today was a question of temperament. Normally, what one would expect in this process is somebody who is even, who would apply the standards as they see them, and they would address the issues. What we saw from Kavanaugh was actually something far more aggressive. In particular, I think of one exchange between he and Senator Klobuchar out of Minnesota, where he kept asking her whether or not she drank and how mm-hmm. that worked. And he kept pushing on the issue. And that's simply not something you would ever see from a judicial nominee ever.
Right, to turn around and ask the lawmaker questions, to try to sort of throw it back in their face.
And he did this over and over and over again, and this is one of those things that you just wouldn't see. And so this question of temperament is really something that shocked me. And frankly, his opening statement did the same thing to me. We saw sort of the flip-flop from real intense anger on the one side to almost weeping on the other. Now, that doesn't mean that he can't be emotional. I'm not saying that. But his willingness to sort of lay that out there as clearly as he did is something that we, generally speaking, do not see from a judicial nominee at the federal level, let alone at the U.S. Supreme Court level.
A lot of the senators on the Democratic side were asking Mr. Kavanaugh, Judge Kavanaugh, if he would recommend that this whole thing go to the FBI for an official nonpartisan investigation. And he just seemed to refuse to answer that. But would that be more proper protocol than what the way they've been doing it? Or what is the most ethical way to handle this?
It would have been more appropriate to put this before the FBI. We're talking about a new allegation that surfaced subsequent to the FBI investigation, and the idea that the Senate Judiciary Committee can rise to the level of the FBI when it comes to an investigation. Asking a question isn't enough. It's the follow-up and what that means. They don't make conclusions. That's true. But a thorough investigation talks about breadth and depth. And that's something that you frequently aren't going to see from a bunch of politicians versus people who are pros who do this day in and day out.
So now we wait to see what's going on. Republican says they will push through with a committee vote before the actual full Senate vote next week, probably. I know there were some senators that were concerned, some Republicans, that they really need all the members of their party to get this nominee through. What do you expect to happen here?
Well, we figured that'll take about 3 days. This will ultimately go to the full Senate. And you know there's going to be enormous pressure on all Republican senators to vote as a block. And they're going to need just about everybody. My guess is that Pence will certainly probably have to come into play. The senators that people need to watch are likely going to be Collins, Snow, Murkowski. Those are probably the big three to see exactly what's going to happen here. Of course, on the Republican side, I suspect you're going to see the Democrats voting in block in opposition. So that's what I would expect.
Any predictions?
I think in the end, Judge Kavanaugh will be confirmed. This is a political question at this point, and I think that those members of the Senate on the Republican side realize that this issue is about the midterms and about the general elections that will be coming up 2 years after that. But they might as well put somebody on the court. Otherwise, they look weak, and they already look weak right now.
Criminal defense attorney and former CIA operative Jack Rice. He was speaking with International Edition's Lori London. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. Ethiopia revokes land leases for a Saudi billionaire and dozens of investors. Islamic State-inspired violence resurfaces in the Philippines despite a local autonomy law. President Trump's highly anticipated meeting to discuss the tenure of Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein has been rescheduled for next week. And an Indian court lifts a ban on women in a prominent Hindu temple in southern India. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA. Thank you.
This is Science in a Minute.
A new study by a pair of researchers at the UK's University of Reading suggests the massive bombing of Europe by Allied forces during World War II not only caused devastation on the ground, but also impacted the ionosphere as well. The ionosphere is the portion of the upper atmosphere ionized by solar radiation. Along with other functions, it impacts the global propagation of radio signals. The study authors reviewed records kept between 1943 and 1945 by the UK's Radio Research Centre. These records contained the daily measurements of the ionosphere. According to the study, there was significant reduction of electron concentration in the atmosphere on the days when the Allies conducted their bombing raids in Europe. The study suggests that shock waves caused by the intense bombing may have heated the upper atmosphere, which increased its loss of ionization. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, the WHO head urges policies at the UN General Assembly to save 10 million lives in 2025. On Sunday, people in the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia are being asked to vote yes or no on a referendum to officially change the Balkan country's name to the Republic of Northern Macedonia. It's a key step to end a 27-year dispute with Greece, which has a province of the same name. By doing so, Macedonia hopes to begin the process of joining both the NATO alliance and the European Union. Wednesday, at a rally before the end of campaigning, Macedonian Prime Minister Zoran Zaev said the country is united and he believes the majority will vote yes for a European Macedonia. The country is trying to emerge from a two-year financial crisis with unemployment exceeding 20% and the lowest average wage in the region. While polls suggest overwhelming support for the change, there's concern about turnout given a boycott call by nationalists opposed to the name change, the result of painstaking negotiation and compromise with Greece, which has held up the country's EU and NATO accession. A minimum of 50% turnout among eligible voters is required for the referendum to be valid. Bruce Wilson is a professor at the EU Centre at Australia's RMIT University. He spoke with International Edition's Victor Beattie about the significance of this referendum.
The outcome of the vote is actually more important than the turnout, because I think that the turnout could be interpreted as acquiescence. But clearly the result of this referendum has got huge implications for Macedonia. If it is positive, if there is a good result from the point of view of the government, then they will be able to look forward to beginning the process of both joining NATO and of joining the European Union.
There's a lot of concern that there's a strong nationalist sentiment in Macedonia and that Russia may actually be somehow involved in the electoral process.
Probably a number of external forces. There's a strong Albanian interest in what happens in this referendum, and clearly the EU has very strong interest as well. To suggest particular evidence of meddling in the outcome of the referendum, well, you want to look at the evidence. And I see no reason to take the result of the referendum as being a credible outcome at face value.
There's a sense that NATO membership may come quickly, but the EU process may take some time.
Well, that's of the very nature of EU accession. There are some 20, 30 chapters to be negotiated each individually and for the what would become the Republic of North Macedonia to demonstrate that it fits with the various expectations and values of EU membership. So that would normally take a minimum of 7-8 years. And in some cases, of course, it takes a lot longer.
Well, Macedonia's economy, of course, is in quite a bit of trouble. They obviously need some sort of EU membership, Western involvement, investment in the country.
Well, I think that the membership of the EU is, at least in the eyes of the Macedonians, an enormous opportunity. And certainly if you look at the experience of Croatia and other Central and East European countries, it's not been an easy process, but they have certainly benefited economically from participation in the EU. Poland, for example, is one of the few countries globally to have had sustained growth through the experience of the global financial crisis.
Why did it take nearly 30 years for Greece and Macedonia to figure this out?
Well, I think you've partly alluded to this yourself, Victor, that there are very strong nationalist sentiments, and Greece has been concerned, very concerned, that any move towards recognition of Macedonia as a state in its own right would threaten the interests of the Macedonian region, which is in the northern part of Greece.
Bruce Wilson of Australia's RMIT University. Once the referendum hurdle is clear, the matter will be taken up by the parliament, which must approve the change by a two-thirds vote and make the necessary constitutional changes. Soldiers went to the polls in the northern region of Iraq, where Kurds will elect regional lawmakers on Sunday. With opposition parties weak, the Kurdistan Democratic Party and Patriotic Union of Kurdistan will likely extend their nearly three decades of sharing power. Last year's failed independence referendum sparked anger and a firm rejection from the Iraqi capital. One analyst said despite the backlash sparked by the referendum, the fact that 3 million Kurds voted for independence will have major implications for the election. More people die from non-communicable diseases like heart attacks, stroke, and cancer than any other group of diseases. The greatest burden of death is in low- and middle-income countries. As VOA's Carol Pearson reports, world leaders at the UN General Assembly heard the head of the World Health Organization propose policies that would save 10 million lives by 2025.
7 in 10 people worldwide die from cardiovascular diseases, cancer, diabetes, and chronic lung diseases, according to a recently published study in The Lancet. These diseases not only rob people prematurely of their lives, they cost enormous amounts of money. The Lancet report estimated that over the next 15 years, the cost to developing countries alone is projected to total more than $7 trillion U.S. dollars. 3 years ago, world leaders pledged to reduce premature deaths from these non-communicable diseases by one-third by the year 2030. At Thursday's UN meeting in New York, WHO Secretary General Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said less than half of the world's countries will meet that target, and he urged world leaders to recommit to these goals. Tedros called for more political commitment and domestic investment.
I know from my own experience that with political commitment, anything is possible. Without it, progress is slow.
Tedros mentioned a list of what he called best buys, policy changes that cost little but produce huge rewards.
WHO's best buys are cost-effective and affordable for all countries. Spending to build a healthier population is not a cost. It's an investment in human capital that pays a rich reward.
Tedros urged countries to increase tobacco taxes, restrict advertising for alcohol, and lower the amount of salt, sugar, and fat in food products. Doing this will lower the risks for diabetes, cancer, heart disease, and stroke. Tedros also advised countries to provide universal health coverage as the best way to prevent and treat non-communicable diseases. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on The Voice of America.
This is International Edition. The late reggae legend Bob Marley once sang, "One good thing about music, when it hits you, you feel no pain." For a young Kurdish immigrant living in San Diego, Marley's observation rings true. Blind since birth, the young musician says music washes away his pain. VOA's Lukman Ahmad visited the talented musician in San Diego, California, and filed this report, narrated by Bejan Hamdard.
Disability can slow you down, but art is limitless. Dylan Dadi is proof of that. The 17-year-old Kurdish immigrant lives and breathes music. He was born blind, but says the inability to see the world has never stopped him from enjoying the beauty of music.
When I was around 4 years old, I started singing, and I also would move my hands as I was playing an instrument.
Music teacher Grace Morrison says Dylan's musical understanding has been impressive from the very start.
I feel like I've taught him nothing because he just came in with this talent and he hears it and just plays it. His musical ear is just, you're born with it, and it's not something I can teach, but it's really fun for me to be able to teach him.
Self-taught Dylan plays various instruments, from drums, guitars, to pianos, and even the violin. Even as a young child, he has always been at the center of family gatherings and parties.
Music is my life. For as long as I can remember, I have been playing music.
Dylan's family immigrated to the United States from Syria to escape the war and also to seek medical attention for their son's blindness. Despite his handicap, his mother says she has never treated Dylan differently.
I never want him to feel different from his siblings. I always look at him the same way as his brothers. He needs more attention and care. I just wish his vision would come and that he can see again.
Dylan's father echoes these sentiments.
What is Dylan? Dylan means heart, and the heart wants a lot of things. But my son Dylan only wants two things, his vision and his music.
Dylan creates melodies and music based on his experiences in life. From the sounds of rockets and bombs in war-torn Syria to the peaceful sounds of laughter and the ocean surf of his new home, Dylan is writing the melodies and the soundtrack of his new life. For Lukman Ahmed, this is Bejan Hamdard, VOA News.
Some very impressive music there. Well, that is our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us. Have a great weekend.